You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
This is our last teaching in the Gospel of John. Man, can you guys believe that? It's a long book, but it doesn't feel long until you get to the end of it, and then you're like, oh, now it's over. What's really interesting about the ending of John is if you're reading it from start to finish, if you get to the end of chapter 20, it feels like this big conclusion. It's like the climax of the movie, and you expect the credits to roll, and then all of a sudden there's one more scene at the end. And it feels like, is this an epilogue? Did John forget, and he had to attack this story on to the end? Why is this here? But actually, as we go through this account tonight, I hope you'll see that this was very purposeful on his part, that there was a very specific reason that he included this one final story, and it's a really encouraging one. Okay, so this passage in John 21 needs some context, and some of this will be review if you've been with us the past couple of weeks, but it's important to set the stage for how incredibly dramatic John 21 is, so we need to rewind just a little bit. So we need to go back to the night before Jesus' death, John 13. This was the night of the Last Supper. He gets together with one final meal, the Passover meal, with his 12 disciples. And at that supper, Jesus tells them, "My children, I will be with you only a little longer. You will look for me, and just as I told the Jews, so I tell you now, where I am going, you cannot come." So they had been with him for 3 years, pretty much nonstop. But he knows that his arrest and death by crucifixion is coming the very next day. So he's like, you guys have been with me this whole time. Tomorrow something is happening that only I can do. And he goes on, he says, "A new command I give you, love one another. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. By this, everyone will know that you are my disciples if you love one another." Which is an important thing that we're going to circle back to, you know, towards the end of the teaching, is that a lot of people, when they think about religion, they think, how do I be really holy? How do I be really righteous? And actually, Jesus says, when I think about what I want from anybody who's following me, I want someone who's really loving. I want people who are able to love one another, and I want a loving community to be built. And that's how people will see that you're different. It's not because you're better than everybody else, not because you're more righteous than everybody else, but because you're more loving than everyone else. Well, Simon Peter has the gift of speaking up, and so he says, okay, Lord, where are you going? You keep talking about this thing you need to do. What is happening? And Jesus replied, where I am going, you cannot follow now, but you will follow later. Peter asked, Lord, why can't I follow you now? I will lay down my life for you. I don't care what is going to happen. I am with you. I will not quit. I will not fail you. In fact, he declares, as recorded in Matthew, even if everyone else deserts you, I will not desert you. These other 11 guys at the table, I hate to say it, Jesus, they're kind of losers, but I'm with you. So don't worry about them because they might fail, but you can count on me. I will be your best friend until the end. And what's really interesting about this declaration is that Peter turns out to be wrong on two levels. And the first level is right here where he says, Jesus, I'm going to lay my life down for you. And he's wrong because he was not about to lay his life down for Jesus. Jesus was about to lay his life down for Peter. Jesus is like, look, I'm going to the cross. I'm going to pay for the sins of all humanity, and that includes yours, Peter. And then Jesus answered, will you really lay down your life for me, Peter? Very truly, I tell you, before the rooster crows, you're going to disown me 3 times tonight. So not only is Peter going to fail to lay down his life for Jesus, he's actually going to disown Jesus. He's going to deny that he has anything to do with him at all. And Jesus says, this is going to happen before the rooster crows tonight. So you have your self-confident declaration, but I'm telling you that something different is going to happen. I already know what's going to happen, Peter, and it's not going to be what you think it's going to be. You know, Peter denied that he was going to deny Jesus. He's like, Lord, I'm with you. I am going to be totally faithful. Because part of the problem was he didn't think that he could fail this badly. He had no category for just completely losing it and failing to take a stand, which kind of makes sense. If you followed Peter in any of the Gospels, you know that he actually has a really strong personality. He doesn't really seem to care what people think. And so in his mind, he's like, if you need somebody who can stand up to everybody else and not worry about anybody else, then I'm your man. And he just couldn't even conceive of the fact that he would be capable of turning on his best friend. And really, in general, self-confidence is often our first mistake. God often wants us to be warned about different situations ahead of time because he realizes how capable we all are of failing, of falling short, even of our own standards. And you can read different warnings in the scriptures. You can hear different warnings from friends. And it's so easy to feel like, well, maybe other people would have a problem with that, but I got this. I don't see why this would really be a big issue. Just the regular mistakes, regular temptations that can come up, you know, the hangout with the ex. And your friend is like, are you sure you want to go and hang out with them? Isn't it possible that, you know, something could happen either physically or emotionally that you would really regret? And it's easy to be like, oh, no, maybe with other people, but I would never fail in that way. I think I can handle this. I'm a mature person. Or maybe you've come out of a lifestyle where you've really struggled with addictions and you know that party is coming up where your former dealer is going to be there. And people are like, is it really a good idea to go to that party? Are you sure that you're going to stay safe and resist your former temptations? And if we're relying on ourselves, it's like, nope, I will totally be able to handle that. And I don't see why that's going to be a big deal. And then we just walk into these situations that have opportunities for us to fail all over the place. And the problem is not the situation itself. The problem is that we just walked blindly into it with complete confidence in ourselves. And if we had an ounce of humility, we would wonder, am I going to be able to do this? Could this possibly be a problem? And yet we so often end up in the same place as Peter, feeling like, nope, maybe everybody else would have a problem with this, but not me, because I'm pretty sure I could handle this. Well, then Jesus finishes up the meal with his disciples. We spent weeks going through his time of talking with them, his time of prayer. And then we get to John 18. And it says, when he had finished praying, Jesus left the upper room with his disciples and crossed the Kidron Valley. So he's headed into Jerusalem. And it's there in the Garden of Gethsemane that Judas shows up with a crowd of soldiers to arrest Jesus. Peter tries to take his stand, and he ends up cutting off a slave's ear in an attempt to protect Jesus. And then Jesus has to heal the guy's ear and then proceeds to have them arrest him. So like his last healing miracle, he has to fix one of Peter's mistakes. And he's like, by the way, aren't you here to arrest me? Let's move on with this. And then at this point, everyone, including Peter, runs away and leaves Jesus alone in the garden to make his way into Jerusalem by himself. So Peter, before he even denies Jesus, fails once or maybe twice, depending on how you count his failures in this whole situation. But then it looks like he kind of regroups a little bit. And it says, the soldiers bound Jesus and brought him to the house of Annas, who was one of the religious leaders in Jerusalem. And Simon Peter and another disciple, John, followed Jesus into the courtyard of the house where Jesus was being tried. And so even though Peter and John ran away, at a certain point, they were like, oh, wait, we said we were going to stand with Jesus. So maybe we could figure out where he is, and maybe we can find a way to support him. And it says it was cold in that courtyard, and the servants and officials stood around a fire they had made to keep warm. Peter also was standing with them, warming himself. It was a charcoal fire that he was standing around, which would have been a really common thing to just get lit at night as a source of warmth. You know, this was springtime in Jerusalem. It would have been really chilly. And it was while he was in this courtyard that he ended up denying Jesus three different times. And like I said, this is review, so I'm not going to go through all three of these in the scriptures. But just as way of reminder, one time he denies Jesus to a middle school girl. That was kind of a softball that was lobbed at him, and he totally whiffs it. And then the final time that he denies Jesus, it was with curses. And at the end of it, he makes eye contact with Jesus as he's swearing at the top of his lungs, I swear by God, I don't know him. And that was right when Jesus was being moved from one building to another. So he just happened to be in the courtyard. And he made eye contact with Peter as Peter is denying him that final time. Luke 22 tells us that he made that eye contact, he heard the rooster crow, and then suddenly the Lord's words flashed through Peter's mind. Before the rooster crows, you will deny three times that you even know me. And it just hits Peter, what just happened. The reality of it crashes in on him, that Jesus was completely right, that that's absolutely what he did. And then it says he left the courtyard and went outside weeping bitterly. Absolutely devastated by his failure, knowing that he had let his Lord down. You know, the rest of John 18 and John 19 is Jesus' trial and crucifixion. And there's no record of Peter at the foot of the cross. He might have been there, but you really get the sense he was such a central figure and everybody knew who he was that if he was not recorded, it almost certainly means that he was not there. Which means he felt so bad about what happened that he just kind of collapsed and went and hid somewhere and stayed away from everybody. And so this is just a recap of the incredible failure that Peter just went through. Failed in every possible way. Now, it's funny because failure can actually be big business in the comedy industry. Like, this is an area where they capitalize on a lot because people try things very earnestly, and it turns out that we're really bad at a lot of things. One favorite TV show in my household is the baking show Nailed It. Have you guys ever watched this? It's where they bring in amateur bakers, and they give them, you know, here is some sort of baking item that we would like you to try to recreate. We're not going to give you any of the directions. Just do the best that you can. And so people will get a hold of things like this, and then they'll post the results. And okay, that's obviously a Cookie Monster cupcake, right? Somebody tried to make that, and this is the result of what they ended up with. It's like, okay, maybe not Cookie Monster. It's definitely monstrous, so I guess we can kind of put that in the same category. An even better one, they're like, how about you make a beautiful Rapunzel cake? You guys ready for the result? Okay, I thought this was a family show. Like, that is a thing of nightmares. And what's amazing to me is that somebody would feel like their baking skills were good enough that they could go on TV, and this is almost always the result. People are almost always humiliated. But then it's not just the shows that are on TV. You can fall into a deep fail video wormhole on YouTube, and there's amazing things that are available, just people trying to do things and caught in positions that I'm like, did you go to the hospital immediately after that? Here's one that I can't tell is staged or if they really did capture this, but I'm like, I would like to know what happened to that woman after that incident. Although, couldn't you totally see this happening to you? I could. Or there's this one, and you're like, oh, why is this a big deal? It's just a man sleeping on a subway. Well, it's not the full picture. Oh, that's going to be disappointing when he wakes up. But it's like, we think this is funny, unless it happens to us, and then it's really embarrassing. But we like to catch other people in failure because it makes us feel good about ourselves, and we can kind of chuckle about those things. But unfortunately, when it comes to what we're reading with Peter here, it's hard to find anything that funny about it. There are some failures that are just painful and embarrassing, and even when you read about them in other people's lives, you just kind of cringe a little bit on the inside. You feel your hands kind of balling up in fists and get a knot in the pit of your stomach, and that's how I feel when I read this story about Peter. And if you think about it, his failure was at multiple levels. He let down Jesus. He said he was going to be a faithful friend, and he totally wasn't, in multiple different occasions that very night. He also disappointed himself. He thought he was better than this, and it turns out that he wasn't. And then the final level that it's sometimes the hardest to admit to ourselves is that he let down the rest of the disciples. He was the natural leader of this band, apart from Jesus. And so when Jesus was arrested, and taken away, this was a chance for Peter to step in and fill those shoes. The rest of the disciples needed somebody to look to, somebody that they could trust. And because Peter failed and then fled, they might not have even known where he was. And you know, when I fail, I can sometimes within my own heart, within my own mind, acknowledge, okay, I let down the Lord, I disappointed myself. But somehow where it really comes home and where it's often the most painful is when I realize how it has affected the other people in my life. And then all of a sudden it feels like, oh, this is actually a really big deal. And this is kind of hard to look at because look at these other people who have been hurt as well. I can't deny that or make that into some sort of spiritual thing. That's the reality of it. Well, John 20 is Jesus's resurrection and when he appears to his disciples. And Peter is part of that group. He's back in with his friends and Jesus appears to him just like to everybody else. And then interestingly, if you finish up John 21 and turn to the next page, it starts in the book of Acts. And the book of Acts centers around Peter as the main leader of the early church in the beginning chapters of Acts. And so you're like, wait, what happened? He went from massive failure to really powerful leader. Did he just move on? Or is it possible that his failure was just swept under the rug, which all too often happens with people in positions of influence? It's like, don't talk about this. Let's just pretend it never happened. Well, actually, that's why we're going to read chapter 21 tonight, because that's not at all what happened. So we get to John 21, and it says, later, Jesus appeared to the disciples beside the Sea of Galilee. This is how it happened. Several of the disciples were there, Simon Peter, the sons of Zebedee, who was John, the author of this gospel, and also his brother James, and four other disciples, so seven guys. And Simon Peter said, I'm going fishing. You know, he was a fisherman by trade. This was kind of an in-between time. You know, Jesus had resurrected, but he wasn't with him all the time. And Peter was like, well, if we're going to wait, we might as well do something. So let's go fishing. And the rest of the guys said, we'll come too. So they went out in the boat, but they caught nothing all night. So fishermen up around the Sea of Galilee would often fish at night because then you would have a nice, fresh catch to bring to the market first thing in the morning when people were buying their food for the day. At dawn, Jesus was standing on the beach, but the disciples couldn't see who he was. They just saw a person. You know, it was low light, and he was a little bit far away. And so he called out, hey, fellows, have you caught any fish? Or if you have a friend that's a fisherman, always ask them what they caught, because they're always going to want to tell you. So he wisely asked them that. He's like, have you caught anything? And they say, no, which is a painful reply if you're a fisherman. And then he said, well, just throw your net on the right-hand side of the boat, and you'll get some. Okay, on the one hand, maybe it's like because he's on the shore and he could see a big school of fish. On the other hand, the right-hand side of the boat was about 7 feet away from the left side of the boat. So he's not suggesting new waters that they could fish in, that maybe they'll find where the fish are. But, you know, it's been a long night. They haven't caught anything. And they're like, okay. So they throw their nets in. And they couldn't haul in the net because there were so many fish in it. So they go from nothing all night to one final attempt, and it completely fills up all of their nets immediately. And then John, the perceptive one, says to Peter, it's the Lord. He calls himself the disciple Jesus loved, not because he thinks Jesus loved him more, but because he didn't want to name himself. And so as soon as that happened, he's like, well, we know who that is on the shore. Now, interestingly, it doesn't tell us explicitly, but there is an account in Luke 5 when Jesus calls Peter to be his disciple that also includes a miraculous catch of fish. And so you have to wonder if this is just a gentle reminder. You know, when Peter had that miraculous catch of fish in Luke 5, he was like, I'm a sinner, and you should not have anything to do with me. And Jesus is like, yeah, I know, and I want you to follow me. And so it's bringing Peter back to how it was that he first understood the grace of God and the incredible blessing that came with that. Well, so John points out it's the Lord, and it says, when Simon Peter heard that it was Lord, he put on his tunic, for he had stripped for work, jumped into the water, and headed for shore. Okay, so on the one hand, he had probably stripped down to next to nothing because they were working really hard. On the other hand, do you usually put on all your clothes before you jump into the water? Like, you could tell he's just not thinking that clearly. He's just so excited that Jesus is there, and he jumps into the water and he starts swimming for shore. And it says the others stayed with the boat and pulled the loaded net to the shore, for they were only about 100 yards from the shore. I mean, honestly, I kind of wonder if the boat passed Peter at a certain point, because, you know, you can only swim so fast, but, you know, he really wants to get there. And it says, when they got there, they found breakfast waiting for them, fish, cooking over a charcoal fire and some bread. Well, isn't that nice that Jesus made them breakfast? And he really did. But that fish is cooking over a charcoal fire. Coincidence? There's all sorts of different ways that memories can be evoked. And they say that olfactory memory, that's the sense that immediately evokes strong emotional memories. Now, this is as soon as you smell cookies that smell like your mom's cookies. As soon as you smell the, you know, scent that was like grandma's house, you smell it somewhere randomly and you're instantly transported immediately back to that moment in time. And so Jesus builds this fire. Peter walks onto the shore and he's hit with the scent of a charcoal fire. And we can just kind of imagine maybe some of Peter's internal monologue, like maybe it's just a coincidence. There's only a few different things you can burn to cook food, so, you know, maybe that's just what he's going for, but there's not usually coincidences with Jesus. But okay, he's not like petty or passive aggressive. He's not taking some jab at me. He's not trying to be mean about this. You know, maybe we could just move on. A lot has happened since that night. Like, you know, my friend dying for the sins of the whole world and then resurrecting from the dead and defeating death. That seems like a much bigger deal than what happened. Also, was it really that bad what I did? I mean, what about Judas? Judas was a disciple too, and he sold Jesus out so that he was able to get arrested. I mean, I said a couple times I didn't know him, but I mean, look at that guy over there. That's way worse. But I keep thinking about how he saw me. He saw me when I denied him that third time. I can't get the image of his face out of my mind. And now I'm looking into those same eyes. Well, Jesus tells him, bring some of the fish you just caught. So Simon Peter went aboard and dragged the net to shore. He's like, yeah, I should go get the fish. Runs away from the awkward situation. Says there were 153 large fish, and yet the net hadn't torn. All right, some people try to take the number 153 and turn it into like some mystical, spiritual number. Like if you add 5 and 3 and then subtract 1, you get 7, and 7 is the number of completion. And so look, it's 150. I don't think it's any of that. I think these were fishermen. And if you talk to any fishermen, they know exactly what they caught. And so they were like, there were 153 fish in that net. That was a lot. Now come and have some breakfast, Jesus said. None of the disciples dared to ask him, who are you? Because they knew it was the Lord. Now, Jesus was in his resurrected body, so they could recognize that it was him, but there were times where it was a little unclear until he revealed himself and said who he was, and this time they were like, look, we shouldn't ask. We know it's him. And then Jesus served them the bread and the fish. This was the third time Jesus had appeared to his disciples since he had been raised from the dead. So they're sitting there having a wonderful breakfast. This is probably the best bread and fish they've ever eaten. And yet, if you were Peter, what was that breakfast like for you? Were you enjoying it, or were you feeling like, I can't really eat right now because I feel really bad and awkward? Well, after breakfast, Jesus sees his opening, and he asks Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? So he directly initiates with Peter. And at first it feels like, really, over breakfast? But actually, as we read on, we're going to find that they had started walking down the beach. And so he had gotten Peter away from everybody else. Hey, let's go for a walk. I don't know if Jesus says what a lot of us said. Hey, Peter, can we talk? And so they start on a walk. And here's the question that he asks them. Simon, son of John, not, did you deny me? Did you fail me? Did you drop the ball? No, he says, do you love me more than these? When he says more than these, he doesn't mean, do you love me more than you love the other guys? He doesn't mean, do you love me more than you love fishing? No. Remember, Peter had said, even if everyone else deserts you, I will never desert you. And now he's asking Peter, do you still want to claim that you love me more than the rest of the guys love me? Do you still want to say that you're better than they are? But also, do you love me? That was what he was telling them the night before he died. A new command I give you, that you need to love one another. So it's like, what I want to get at, Peter, is the love that you have for me and for the people around you. That's the real issue here. You know, Jesus doesn't want Peter to be the most powerful or the most brilliant or the most gifted or the most whatever you think the qualification needs to be in order to be able to be used by God. No, what Jesus wants is for Peter to be the most loving. Peter replied, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. Then feed my lambs, Jesus told him. Now, earlier in his ministry, Jesus had said, I'm the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. There are going to be people who follow me, and they're not going to know what to do. They're going to need someone to guide them and take care of them and feed them the truth of my word. So he's like, Peter, that's what I want you to do. I want you to be somebody who cares for the people who are trying to follow me. Also, Peter says, you know that I love you. Notice what he doesn't say. He doesn't say, you know that I love you more than these. No, that's completely dropped in this statement. Going through that failure means that the comparison is gone. It's just him and the Lord standing there. He just has to answer to Jesus, and he doesn't say anything about anybody else. Jesus repeated the question a second time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Yes, Lord, Peter said, you know that I love you. Then take care of my sheep, Jesus said. Same charge, just slightly different wording. A third time he asked him, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Peter was hurt that Jesus had asked the question a third time. He said, Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you. Now, of course, from our perspective, it's obvious why Jesus asked three times, because Peter denied him three times. But in the midst of this conversation, Peter hears the question, the exact same question repeated three times, which has to make him feel like, do you not believe my answer? I'm trying to answer honestly. He was hurt. And part of what we see in Jesus drilling down in and really pressing Peter on this point is that Jesus always goes deeper than we want him to. There are areas in each person's life that we feel like if I never have to think about that again, if I never have to deal with that ever again, please, for the love of God, let's never talk about it. And Jesus says, we need to talk about this because I love you. And I know that if we don't, that you're going to carry this around with you for the rest of your life, and I don't want that for you. And so I'm not going to settle for the first answer or the second answer. I'm going to go further than that. You know, I've had to go in for physical therapy for different things, and it would be a bad physical therapist if they were like, oh, is that the part that hurts? I won't touch it. No, that's the very part that they go after. And I pay them money to cause me pain because I know that's the only way to get better. And Jesus is the ultimate physician, the ultimate healer, who knows exactly what it's going to take for us to be able to be healed. He doesn't want things to remain hidden. He wants to bring things out into the open so that he can actually interact with us on them. And the things that you feel like are the worst things that you've ever done, well, he already knows what those are. And he's not ashamed of those. He's not embarrassed to talk to you about those. He's going to go right to those for your sake. He also knew that Peter's denials weren't a one-off, that they flowed from that deeper self-confidence. And that's really part of what he's trying to get at. He's like, this was not an random mistake. It comes from a deeper issue that you have, Peter, and that is your self-confidence. You know, this idea of self-confidence, I think we want to be confident people, right? We want to believe in ourselves. We don't want to just always be worried about what people think about us. But the problem with self-confidence is that it's based on self, that I look to within myself to feel good about myself. And so it's what I bring to the table, what I'm good at, what my strengths are. It's what I'm capable of, either because of how God has made me or because of the things I've worked really hard at and I feel like this is what I can do and isn't this a good thing? But then it's where I try to avoid failure. So I'm going to make sure that I don't move into areas that I'm not naturally good at because that might shake my self-confidence. And God forbid if I do fail, then I need to cover that up, oftentimes even from myself, because I can't look at anything negative. I can only focus on what's positive so I feel good about myself. And what's God's perspective on us? When he looks at us, does he think, oh, yeah, you're a pretty good person, and how can I help you feel good about yourself? No, interestingly, he comes at it from a very different perspective that at first seems kind of jarring. You know, Jesus' question to Peter, do you love me? That's the question to all of us. And so it raises the question, who is capable of truly loving God? And here's the answer that God gives. In the book of Romans, quoting multiple different places from the Old Testament, it says, there's none who seeks for God. There is none who does good, not even one. So when God looks out at the human race, he doesn't see a bunch of good people that are basically good that just need to feel better about themselves. No, he sees a race of people who are thinking only about themselves and as such have no love for God. And so when he looks at that, he thinks, well, it's not about who's a good person, who's a bad person. Are you righteous enough? Do your good deeds outweigh your bad deeds? No, he asks the question, do you love God and do you love other people? And all of a sudden, that's a very different question. And then instead of asking us to be loving, what he does is he chooses to love us. 1 John 4 tells us this is love, not that we loved God, but that he loved us and sent his son as a sacrifice to take away our sins. That there's actually a tremendous amount of freedom in being able to acknowledge to myself, oh, I don't love God, at least not the way that I should. I certainly don't love other people the way that I should. And that's actually the very reason that Christ came to die, is to pay for all the ways in which we fall short in loving God and loving other people. And so instead of trying to hold it together and trying really hard, instead I can just go to God and say, actually, I'm not loving, but you are. And so will you accept me on the basis of your son's work instead of on the basis of my own? And God says, anyone who's willing to do that will be in a permanent love relationship with God. And then what's great is instead of having self-confidence, we can grow in godly confidence, which is actually very different. Because God doesn't want you to feel bad about yourself. It's not either feel really good about myself or feel really bad about myself. No, there's actually a different way forward for people who have a relationship with God. What God wants is you to feel confidence about him, that he's the one doing the work. He's the one who is using you. He's the one that's able to work through you despite all of your problems and weaknesses. And so any success that we experience is actually due to his faithfulness, not due to our own capabilities and efforts. I mean, you have to put yourself forward, but for you to look at your life and be like, look at all these things that I've done. No, those are gifts from God, which means you're free to enjoy them as opposed to having to hold on to them. And then failure is an opportunity to grow closer to God and to learn instead of being this devastating thing that just completely wipes out any sense of self-worth. In fact, failure leads to humility if you draw close to God. Because you can look at it and just think, well, I have problems, I have weaknesses, I have areas where I fall short. God knew ahead of time all the things that I was going to fail at, and he's already provided for that through his son. And so we don't have to be afraid of failure, which means we don't have to cover up failure. We can actually go and talk to God about it. You know, a couple years ago, I decided I wanted to try to run a half marathon I'm kind of a runner, but I thought, well, if I go for a half, then that'll increase my distance, and I think that'll be really good for me. And it was actually the 2022 marathon, but this is, you know, the picture that I found. And what was cool was I actually completed the half marathon, and I ran the whole time. I'm not fast. I run like 11-minute miles. I think I would run an 11-minute mile if a bear was chasing me. Like, that's just the speed that I go, and there's no speeding me up. But here's the wild thing. I think part of the reason I was able to finish was because as I was going through the training process, you have the once-a-week longer runs, and they make those longer and longer as you go. And once I got past about 5 or 6 miles, I was not able to complete a single long run during the training process. I always had to stop and walk for long distances, or I would feel super nauseous. And so I headed into the half, and I was like, well, I don't know. I'm just going to do the best I can, and if I finish by walking, that's still finishing. And so I think in a good way, it kind of set my expectations sort of low. I'm just going to do the best I can and see what happens. And then that actually was what enabled me to just hang in there and keep running. I think if I had finished some of those longer runs, I would have gone in with a lot of confidence. Look at what a good runner I am. I'm not a good runner. But going through that failure was part of what grew my endurance. And I think the same is true for a lot of areas of our lives. It's the failure that we go through that can lead to future success. So Jesus asked Peter this third time, and Peter says, Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you. And Jesus said, then feed my sheep. Gives him his third call to ministry. Miles Stanford in the Complete Green Letter says, it's more than comforting to realize that it is those who have plumbed the depths of failure to whom God invariably gives the call to shepherd others. This is not a call given to the gifted, the highly trained, or the polished as such. Without a bitter experience of their own inadequacy, they're quite unfitted to bear the burden of spiritual ministry. It takes a man who has discovered something of the measures of his own weaknesses to be patient with the failures of others. Such a man also has a firsthand knowledge of the loving care of the chief shepherd and his ability to heal one who has come humbly to trust in him and him alone. The Lord Jesus does not give the charge, be a shepherd to my lambs, to my sheep, on hearing Peter's self-confident affirmation of undying loyalty. No, he gives it after Peter has utterly failed to keep his vows and has wept bitterly in the streets of Jerusalem. If you've never failed, then you can't understand when other people fail. And anybody who's going to try to follow God, they're going to fail a lot. So actually what we need are some experts in failure and in getting restored. Jesus wraps up, he says, I tell you the truth, when you were young, you were able to do as you liked. You dressed yourself and went wherever you wanted to go. But when you're old, you will stretch out your hands and others will dress you and take you where you don't want to go. Jesus said this to let him know by what kind of death he would glorify God. This idea of stretching out your hands, Peter was crucified later in life. And Jesus is telling him ahead of time, this is going to be what happens to you. It was about 30 years later, somehow Peter was able to serve for 30 years knowing that this was the end. But Jesus told him, you wanted to go to your death for me, and actually you will, just not yet. Then Jesus told him, follow me. Well, Peter turned around and saw behind them the disciple Jesus loved was following them. So he looks back there and John's like, oh, sorry. And Peter asked Jesus, well, what about him, Lord? And Jesus replied, if I want him to remain alive until I return, what is that to you? Peter, we're not talking about John. I have plans for John. I'll talk about John, about my plans for John. Right now, we're talking about Peter. So Peter, let's keep focused on the plans for Peter. As for you, follow me. Now, with Peter answering the questions, what did we say? The comparison was gone. Well, mostly. It's actually kind of helpful to realize that it wasn't completely gone for him. He sort of went right back to it because when do we ever change that fast? But Jesus gives him his call and Peter answers. You know, he devoted the rest of his life to serving God's people. In fact, he wrote a letter later in life. If you read the book of 1 Peter, turn to chapter 5. And he writes to the elders or the church leaders among you, I appeal as a fellow elder. What is the one thing that I want you to do? I want you to shepherd the flock of God among you. So this imagery that Jesus gave him is what gave Peter the vision for the rest of his life. And that's exactly what he did for the next 30 years. And then he went to his death refusing to deny Jesus. He was faithful to the end and died a very painful, excruciating death because he was never going to deny his Lord ever again. Why? Because he was stronger? No. Because he understood the love of God at an even deeper level, and that gave him the ability to persevere. So this passage just brings us face to face with the question, who am I when I fail? I can't see the future for myself or for any of you here, but I have one guarantee for every single person in this room. You will fail. Maybe some of you are sitting here tonight thinking about that one thing from the past that you try so hard to forget about, and you're sitting here thinking, who told this chick I was coming tonight? And nobody did. I don't know what it is that's on your heart, but the Lord knows. And he brought you here to hear this passage tonight. If you're sitting here tonight and you can't think of those one or two things that make you feel embarrassed every time they come to your mind, don't worry. You've got some coming. Maybe tonight. I don't know. The Lord knows what you have coming. But you have something that's going to happen in your life that's going to be massive, embarrassing public failure. And so what are you going to do? How are you going to handle that? Are you going to run? Are you going to hide? Are you going to refuse to deal with it? Try to keep it in the darkness and make sure that it never gets discussed ever again? Are you going to justify and blame shift? Talk about how it wasn't your fault, how it was everybody else's fault, and you were just the victim of some bad circumstances? Or are you going to talk to Jesus about it? He's the good friend that's going to go right at the thing that you don't want to talk about, but it's because he loves you. And he knows how enslaving some of these failures are to us until we actually start to deal with them. And it's not just for your benefit that he wants you to get healing from your failures, because once you've received acceptance from Jesus, you can allow your failures to become blessings to other people. Now, when people come to me, what do they want to hear? Do they want to hear everything that I've ever done right and all the steps of faith that I've ever taken and the successes that I've had? No, those are actually super boring stories, because every step of faith that we take are all kind of similar to one another. No, what people get encouragement from are all the ways that I've failed, all the mistakes that I've made, because when I succeed, I don't know why that worked. But when I fail, I can point to, okay, I did this wrong, or we tried that and it didn't work, or here's an issue that God is revealing in my life. Those are the things that we can learn from. And so my failures can actually be used to benefit other people. Man, wouldn't it be great if we could learn from one another's failures? That would save us a lot of time and trouble in our own lives. But you need to get healing from areas where you failed so that God can use you as a blessing to other people. If you are always thinking about ways that you've messed up, you're going to be self-focused as opposed to others-focused, and it's going to keep you from being a loving person. What's interesting is Peter's denials are in all four Gospels. Matthew, Mark, Luke, John record that Peter denied Christ three times. Only John includes his restoration. I think partly because Peter was dead by this point, and so John knew, I can tell this story, even though he didn't want it included in the first three. And he and Peter were really good friends. And he wanted to explain, how did we get from him denying Christ to him being the leader of the early church? I think the more important point is, Peter must have wanted the church to know about his failure, so that when he got up and took amazing stands for God, none of the credit, none of the glory went to him. He didn't want to talk about all the amazing things that he did. What he wanted to talk about was how much he failed and how gracious God was to him. Because we can look at somebody like Peter and think, well, if God could work with someone like him, maybe there's a chance for someone like me. And I am absolutely positive that that's exactly what Peter would want us to come away with. So what do we conclude from this last section of the Gospel of John? You'll fail. I promise. It could be a negative thing, or it could be a relieving thing. Instead of being afraid of it, when it happens, we will be a little bit less surprised by it. And so the call is, let God minister to you in your failure. Don't run away and don't hide. Let him get at those things that you feel really bad about. Let him love you like he loved Peter. Let him bless you like he blessed Peter. And then, just like Peter, let your failings be an encouragement to others so that they can see that they too can experience the grace of God. Lord, we're so grateful that your Spirit thought that it was important to include this account of Peter's restoration. We're grateful that he had the humility to have all four Gospels include all the details about how he denied you. So thanks that he was truly under grace about that major public failure. But thanks, too, that you really wanted us to understand how it is that you dealt with him. And it was so gentle, Lord. It was so kind. And yet it was so straightforward because you knew that was going to be best for him. And so, Lord, I'm sure that there are people sitting here tonight who were really struck by that because they think that you are different, that you're going to be much harsher, that you're going to be angry with them. Pray they would see you through Peter's eyes as the Lord who loves them, who gave himself up for them, who wants to be close to them. Pray for anyone who has a thing in their life that they've never talked about. Pray that they would see this as a call to bring it out into the light, to talk to you and to some trusted friends, to experience that healing that's available. And Lord, this was such a clear example of your grace, and we know that that grace is available to anyone who's willing to call out to you. So pray for people here tonight who do not yet have that relationship with you, that they would see this as your invitation for them to come to you so that you can forgive all of their sins, and then thanks that they can spend the rest of their lives learning how to live under grace. Amen.